This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up later on today's show, there is a bluegrass event coming up, and we will talk with one of our favorite bluegrass musicians of Cottonwood, Jill Weiss, and we will hear an oral history excerpt from the Red River Rainbow Seniors, their Breaking Barriers podcast. But first, joining me by phone from Minot is Assistant Professor of Chemistry, Dr. Christopher Heath at Minot State University. Dr. Heath, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There is a new program launching at Minot State, the first of its kind in North Dakota and only the second program of the likes in the entire country, soon to be offering a medicinal plant chemistry major. Why did you want to start this program at Minot State?
Well, it's the culmination of what's been over a year and a half of discussion on campus. One of the things that occurs on our campuses and should occur on all state university campuses, and I believe does, is constant evaluation for what sorts of new things should we be adding to service our students, the region, the state. And one of the things that came out of these internal discussions was the possibility of a program related to the medicinal cannabis industry in particular. And so through a number of conversations with parties from across campus, and we ended up developing this this program. Useful for some other industries, but primary target is to provide scientists for some of the technical aspects related to that particular industry.
So how will it work? What will students and professors be doing?
So what we've done is we've taken the chemistry degree that we already have, a very traditional chemistry degree, and we've added an option that still includes all of that, but focused on the extraction, the identification, and the purification of compounds that are found in plant material. And so they'll focus on those aspects through their study of chemistry and learn some of those techniques and the science behind those specifically, so that when they leave here, then they can work in industries such as that, the extraction of, for example, CBD oil out of hemp or cannabis leaves, or the extraction of alpha acids out of hops for craft brewing and those types of things.
Yeah, boy, it is a growing industry. I was driving by a Stop and Go recently, and the gas station was advertising CBD oil. And I just think back 10, maybe even 5 years ago, in my world anyway, that was unheard of.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's becoming more and more popular all the time. And we have a lot we need to learn yet. And as to what it is, the oil, it's a mixture of a number of different things. And in all likelihood, some of them have some beneficial effects. Some of them probably have very little physiological effect. And there may even be a few things in there that have some negative effects. Mm-hmm. And so what will I expect to happen over the next several years as we finally are having avenues to study those more carefully, open up with interest and hopefully some funding that becomes available as well. We can determine what what components of those mixtures are beneficial, and then be able to separate them out, and then eventually have products on the market that really only contain the components that people want instead of having to ingest all of it.
Sure. Well, and obviously with medical marijuana or medicinal cannabis, what you are trying to do is take out the parts that are beneficial without having that THC component that can impact the mind. And then you use the parts that are strictly medicinal. What do you do with the other parts?
That's a good question, and no one's actually asked me that before. Ultimately, at this point, I would presume that they're destroyed and disposed of. But we don't have any on hand here yet that we've dealt with, so I haven't actually thought too hard on that. That's what we would do with them, but on the production side, I presume that's the case, but I need to actually find that out.
Okay, we'll check back in a few months with you. Are there security concerns on campus when you're launching a medicinal cannabis, a medicinal plant chemistry major?
That was certainly part of our discussion. What we're intending to do in the classroom is to not actually deal with bulk cannabis, because we don't need to. The techniques that we're going to be looking at are the same as we'd use to extract other things from other plants. So, for example, most people listening are familiar and probably have done daily an extraction from coffee beans. Mm-hmm. When we brew coffee, we're really just extracting some of the stuff out of the coffee bean into a water-based solution and then consume it. That's exactly the same concept. And so we can use analogs instead of having to use marijuana. We can use other analogs to teach the techniques. And with industrial hemp now having its regulations relaxed with the latest farm bill, that's one that we're definitely looking at using. We don't have the high THC, so.
Yeah, what did the most recent farm bill open up for you?
Well, it removed industrial hemp from the Schedule I drug list, and so so it's now considered an agricultural crop, and we can then work with it without having the drug regulations. It's the same base plant. The difference is the industrial hemp has extremely low amounts of THC, enough to not be have any psychoactive effects. The exact percentage now is slipping my mind, but it's in the single-digit tenths of a percent. And so the other compounds, the CBD oil, for instance, can be extracted from industrial hemp, and we don't have the THC to deal with. So if a student were to try to smuggle some out in their pocket, there's really not a consequence, where if we're dealing with marijuana, we would need to have somewhere that it's stored. We'd have to keep very careful tabs on it. In the lab, all the security concerns come up. And with hemp, we don't have to have those because it doesn't have that value.
Sure. Kind of like drinking a non-alcoholic beer.
Yes.
Okay. Who is doing this extraction now on a large scale? Is it primarily companies? Is it primarily research outlets?
It's, as far as consumers are seeing, there are companies that are doing this. At this point, they do have, some of them have trained chemists that are involved in the process. Smaller companies may have maybe consulting from a chemist and have other people who are either trained somewhere to do the technician part or else are learning on the fly. And so one of our hopes with this program is to be able to provide future workers with the scientific training to very quickly be able to come into these industries and do the work more efficiently, you know, do it better with the scientific precision that the industry is hopefully going to come to expect.
When will the program officially start? Does it start this coming fall?
Due to just the time it takes for our internal things, we actually approved it last late October.
Okay.
And as such, could have students start to enroll in the program, but it couldn't be printed in our catalog until the one that's for this fall. And okay. So that's sort of the visual, I guess, visible release. But we have a couple students internally who've either switched to or added this as their major, and we have some transfer students coming in. So we have a small cohort of students who'll be starting in what's essentially their second year of the program, as well as our new incoming freshmen and a few of those who are interested in the program. So we sort of did a soft opening, I guess, in business terms with it. But
are you having to explain to some people that this isn't going to school and getting a degree in smoking pot?
Not quite to that extreme yet, but I have had some inquiries that through conversation, this is clearly not what they were looking for. It's a straight up science degree, and so someone who would be unlikely to thrive in a traditional chemistry degree is likely going to struggle here as well, because they're at their core the same program.
Sure, and there's so lots of math, I would guess.
Yep, students need to be strong in math. We've got a year of calculus as part of the program. We've got a year of calculus-based physics. There's statistics. Of course, the full 4 years worth of chemistry courses in all the areas of chemistry, as well as biology that's in there as well. A little more biology than our traditional chemistry majors would have. We've added a plant biochemistry course be taught in our biology department to look at how do plants produce all the compounds that we can find in the plant material and some of those aspects. So it's a handful. It's definitely a challenging program, but also one that should be very rewarding both academically, intellectually, and hopefully financially for our students as well.
We're visiting with Dr. Christopher Heath, an assistant professor in chemistry at Minot State University, about the new medicinal plant chemistry major that will be offered at Minot State, the first of its kind in the state and only the second in the country. Where's the other program?
The first program of this type is actually at Northern Michigan University up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As it worked out, my first faculty position was at a neighboring school up there. So as they were developing their program, I was quite familiar with it and then got here. And that's part of why I was involved in the discussions here on Minot State's campus.
Very nice. I would imagine that in these broad academic circles, there's a lot of people reaching out and seeing who's testing what. And is there collaboration?
Not overtly, although there is some. I had a few conversations with the folks at Northern as we were developing and shortly after releasing ours. One of the first emails I got was from the head of their program there, essentially, congratulations on the new degree, welcome to the club. I know one other school that, since we rolled ours out, there is one other school also in Michigan that's rolled out a similar program. And I've got some friends there that had reached out to me for some inside scoop on what we were working on and what we had done as well. So there is a little bit of that, but not a real close collaboration yet, although we've talked about it some, and we'll see how things evolve here over time.
When it comes to medicinal plants, there's really no shortage of plants out there that have a large degree of medicinal opportunities. Medical marijuana gets the lion's share of the thought process here. That's where everybody's mind goes right away. Will you be studying other plants for their medicinal properties? Anything from dandelions and burdock to potential mushrooms?
The study of the actual medicinal properties is a bit beyond the scope of what we can do here at a small school like Minot State. Those mm-hmm. sorts of studies are better left to a proper medical school. So where we will focus is how to identify what sorts of things are in the plant, and if any have been identified as having medicinal benefit, how do we separate them from the other things in the plant? And those are things that we definitely do plan to study. So there's a number of parts of the whole picture, and our plan at this point in time is to focus on the how do we get them out of the plant, how do we identify what they are, and how do we know that we have them pure without other things mixed in, because that suits our current capabilities and expertise a little better, and the mission of our institution here as well.
What kind of career opportunities are there for students pursuing a degree in medicinal plant chemistry?
The most obvious one is working in that industry as extraction and quality assurance, quality control type of positions, but also in other industries as well. These are the same skills that someone in the pharmaceutical industry, looking at quality control and quality assurance of more traditional medications, would need. And the food science industry as well, when we look to determine the purity and the safety of foodstuffs, again, the same skill set. And so those types of jobs a student doing this program would be very well prepared for. Mm-hmm. And with the strong traditional chemistry core, any other job that someone with a traditional chemistry degree would be qualified for. These students will be as well.
Are you hoping that Minot State becomes like a feeder school into some of these industries? Like recruiters might come?
Yep, absolutely. That is one of our hopes. Feel very, very confident that as the industry evolves, that's the direction that they will go. I've seen the same sort of thing in the craft brewing industry. Started out with people that like to make beer in their garages and their kitchens and expanding. And over time, as those breweries became successful, they discovered that to get the consistency of the product that they really needed to go into that venture, they needed more control, more precision, and more understanding of the process.
More science.
People that had that were scientists. And so we've seen people with scientific backgrounds and interest in beer start to become the brewmasters. In fact, one of our colleagues here at Minot State is part owner and the brewmaster of a local brewery here in town.
Mm.
Yeah, I think we'll see the same thing in the medicinal cannabis industry as well, where the industry will really be looking for people with that scientific background.
Well, there's that joke, what's the difference between science and messing around, writing stuff down, right?
Yep.
We're visiting with Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Minot State University, Dr. Christopher Heath, and we are talking, of course, about the medicinal plant chemistry major coming to Minot State University, but you also have a number of other interesting hobbies. How did you get into falconry?
It's a bit of a long story, but the short version is I saw something actually on Prairie Public Television when I was young, probably 7 years old, that one of the segments had a falconer with a kestrel, and he'd send it across the backyard to grab a moth or something, and the concept had fascinated me. At the time, my dad knew somebody who had done it in the past, and he made a comment of the time commitment necessary and that not something I would be able to do yet. And so I kind of put it out of my mind, and through a series of fortunate events, it came back kind of into my mind as something possible in adulthood. And when I moved out to my first faculty position out at that school in Michigan, there happened to be a master falconer in town who I met, I talked to, got along with, and was willing to take me, pun only partially intended, under his wing and teach me to do that. So while I was there, I had a couple of red-tailed hawks that I trained and hunted with.
Wow. What are you hunting?
There we were hunting squirrels. Lots of woods up in the UP, and so that was my preferred quarry. I grew up in the prairies and like walking around in the woods anyway, so any chance to go for a walk in the woods was good, and to do it with a bird following looking for squirrels was the pinnacle of enjoyment for me.
What do you look for in a bird when you are deciding if it's going to be one to train?
That depends on the falconer. A lot of people look for a really big feet or a physical attribute. Some people look at its behavior when you trap it, as we'd for red-tailed hawks, you typically trap them from the wild, and so one that hits the trap really hard is likely going to be a good hunter. There's some other things one might look for. My mentor had commented he saw one once that had a something it had caught and was take it up in the air and then would drop it and catch it like it was playing, and he had wished that he had trapped that one, because any bird that has time to play then is an exceptional hunter and would have probably made a great falconry bird.
I bet that is incredible to see. And you might get a little extra money here outside of the school season, like hunting rabbits from gardeners. They would love to have a falcon come over, I would think.
Yeah, there's some some prohibitions that prevent me from doing it here at the moment, but I'm hoping someday to be back to doing that again, and yeah, I might look into that.
I got to ask, did you find out about these prohibitions by looking up the rules, or because you were toeing that line and you got caught?
No, I had done my homework before I moved back to North Dakota, and knew it's a city ordinance that I'm working on, so currently working on conversations to figure out how to either get that changed or get an exception so that I can go back to pursuing that again.
Dr. Christopher Heath, an assistant professor of chemistry at Minot State University, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Coming up next, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. And by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Birds are fascinating creatures, especially for biologist Chuck Lura. In this week's Natural North Dakota, we learn about birds who make their homes in little cavities, like a hole in a tree.
I was sitting on a downed tree in the Turtle Mountain Aspen Forest recently when a chickadee seemingly emerged from the trunk of a nearby aspen with something in its mouth. It flew to a nearby tree, dropped the object, then flew back into the tree. This was repeated several times. It was quickly apparent that this bird was either excavating or cleaning out its nesting cavity. I would never have spotted the cavity without seeing the chickadee travel back and forth. Actually, it took a couple trips by the chickadee before I could spot the cavity, where a small branch had been broken off and rotted a bit. Birds choose different locations for nesting, and one of the factors in nest site selection is to choose a site relatively safe from predators. Many birds carefully place their nests well hidden amongst the foliage of trees or shrubs or on the ground, and some construct their nests inside a tree. What could be better? Woodpeckers, of course, excavate their own nest cavities. Many other birds, however, utilize an existing cavity. The list of these birds might surprise you and includes house wrens, bluebirds, chickadees, nuthatches, purple martins, owls, wood ducks, as well as mergansers, buffleheads, goldeneyes, and the kestrel or sparrowhawk. House wrens commonly utilize birdhouses, and a birdhouse is nothing more than a fancy constructed nesting cavity. We have several wren houses in our yard, along with a wren house with an entrance hole that's a little bigger than most, which has been claimed by a pair of tree swallows over the past few years. It might surprise you, but natural nesting cavities are generally in short supply. We're perhaps a bit too efficient at taking down dead or dying trees. I was rather surprised to see an article by the Virginia Department of Forestry suggesting cavity trees for woodlots. They suggest 10 to 20 live or dead small cavity trees and 2 to 5 larger trees per acre be left on woodlots for cavity nesters. So consider putting up some birdhouses. And the next time you see a chickadee or other cavity nester flitting around, you might consider observing it for a bit to see if you can find a nest cavity. And if you have some trees that are dead or dying, consider leaving them for the birds if possible. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botno. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Next time on The Pulse,
I am a mother.
Puerto Rican,
Polish, and Italian.
Our identities have so many different components.
I'm a West Coast girl.
I guess Black.
Woman.
We'll explore identity and what happens when our sense of self is challenged.
It was like losing an entire half of me in some way. It was a rootlessness.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, Doug Hamilton visits with musician Jill Weiss about an upcoming bluegrass festival. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The Public Service Commission has voted to deny a siting for a siting permit for a northwestern North Dakota wind farm. The 200-megawatt Burke wind farm was to be built in Burke and Montrail counties, but agencies such as the State Game and Fish Department and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service objected because of wildlife habitat in the area. Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk says it was frustrating to deal with because there had been correspondence from the two agencies to the developer going back a few years.
Where they said, this is a difficult spot. There's a lot of problems here. You really should consider someplace else. And the company didn't heed that. And so, and they're really, their tune never changed.
The vote was unanimous. The developer, NextEra Energy, could appeal the decision to the district court. Fedorchuk says she believes it is the first time the PSC has denied siting for a wind project. Fargo police are putting out a warning about a new illegal drug threat. Possibly contaminated marijuana sold in Fargo sent two people to Sanford Medical Center in Fargo this past weekend with serious reactions. One victim was reported to be in a coma. Another victim is cooperating with investigators as they track down the source of the drug. Here's Police Chief Dave Todd.
This incident here that has lately happened with two young females, we're still investigating. We're certainly concerned about it. We have some illegal product that we have sent to the state lab that we want to have analyzed to see exactly what is in that product or if that's what caused this reaction to these two young females.
Chief Todd says so far there have been no other reports of anyone being poisoned by marijuana in the Fargo area. And North Dakota scored mostly well on a recent survey about which states are the best for working dads. Jill Gonzalez is an analyst for Wallet Hub, a personal finance website. She said the survey measured each state against several factors when determining which states are the best and worst for working dads. Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Jersey scored in the top three spots, while Louisiana was ranked dead last. North Dakota was ranked in the top half at 12th, but ranked fourth overall in the economic and social well-being category. Gonzalez says this is because North Dakota has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. She says one area North Dakota did not fare well in was work-life balance, where it ranked at 43rd.
First and foremost comes a parental leave policy score that is represented statewide. And right now, North Dakota does not have that. So that's one area that could really use some improvement. We also looked at things like the average length of a workday for males, which tends to be a little bit longer in North Dakota. The average commute time is just that, about average for males in the state.
Gonzalez says North Dakota scored well in the other categories, ranking 8th in child care and 11th in health. She says the low work-life balance ranking most likely kept the state out of the top 10. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
There are traditions to observe when touring Dublin on Bloomsday.
Every visitor who visits us on Bloomsday particularly, they buy the bar of soap.
When exploring the wilds of Hokkaido.
Sometimes there are hot springs that come out of the ground right next to the lake, or you can dig in the sand and create your own hot spring bath.
Or sailing Hudson Bay.
The weather almost always scared me more than the bears did.
Find out on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
It's time to talk about a music festival with somebody who's been on Main Street a few times, and that's Jill Weiss. She's with the Cottonwood Band, and we just heard a gentle refrain from the Cottonwood Band because you guys do some pretty bouncy stuff,
oh,
too.
Oh, we go all over the place. We sure do.
Well, Jill is joining us from our Bismarck studio, and when she isn't playing bluegrass, she's an EMT, she's a nurse, and does all that good stuff as well. But we're going to talk about the 29th Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival, which is coming up June 14th and 15th at the Cross Ranch State Park just outside of Washburn, your stomping grounds. What's going to be different this year, Jill?
Oh, we've got two amazing headline bands. We have the Clay Hess Band coming from Ohio. And great, great singer-songwriter Clay is. We've got the Edgar Loudermilk Band featuring Jeff Autry, who's a phenomenal guitar player. They're from Alabama. We've got Christy Golddaddy coming back on the scene, and she actually grew up down near Napoleon. And she went off to Tennessee to college, and now she's back living in Minnesota. So we have her country band coming to play. And we have the Little Blue Stems, which is two sisters and two brothers from Elgin, North Dakota, going to play with us.
Wow. So some variety.
Big age variety and ability and just tons of fun.
Okay, so describe the scene for us at the Cross Ranch State Park.
The scene there is beautiful. Of course, it's right along the Missouri River, and there's a nature conservancy right near with the big old buffalo hanging out there. And we have a nice little stage inside the park, and we encourage people to bring their lawn chair, maybe some bug spray, maybe an umbrella. And we have a great guy, Corey Pierce, doing sound from Bismarck, and Terry Schwartz is our MC from Jamestown. And just it's a great family-friendly I say safe event for people to come and bring their kids. And we have lots of overflow camping area that is first come, first served. The electric sites are all booked for now, but we just pile everybody in. And great music Saturday or Friday night. We kick off 6:30 to 10:30. And, of course, then after the stage is done is when the jamming begins.
Okay, so it doesn't stop at 10:30.
It does not stop at 10:30.
So how many people do you expect over a couple of days like that?
You know, we like to sneak around 300-400 in there is a good fit. I think Eric Lang, he's the manager of the Cross Ranch State Park, he gets nervous because I want to just fill it even more. And he's like, oh, we only have so much room. But 400 is a nice crowd, and a lot of those folks are really camping. Some folks come up for the day on Saturday morning. We have an open stage from 10 to 11, and that's where anyone can go up on stage and play a song or two. We have a full sound set up, and it's just fun for people to maybe do a duo, or somebody might get up there with the guitar and sing a song. And then from 1 until 3 is my favorite part of the weekend, which is the Learn a Bluegrass Song Workshop. And so each of the headline bands will be teaching for 1 hour, and this is free. Just bring your banjo, your guitar, your mandolin, your fiddle, your voice, if you have an upright bass, and just enjoy those 2 hours of learning a couple of songs with these headline bands that we have.
So no training involved here?
None.
Mean, no pre-training, I should
None.
Say.
Nope.
You'll learn from some experts.
You really do, and that's what's so fun and encouraging is to sit down with some of our nation's finest, I say, and get some ideas, and you'll see people just become lifelong friends, and, you know, oh, what kind of banjo strings, you know, should I get? And it's just a great 2 hours of camaraderie, it really is.
How much does it cost?
You know, if you're coming just on Friday night, it's $15, and on Saturday for the day is $25, and the whole weekend is $35.
Well, that's pretty reasonable. Mm-hmm.
It really is. And 16 and under are free. So people want to bring a bunch of kids or whatever. You know, we try to keep it very reasonable. Thankfully, we have a lot of businesses in Washburn and Center who help support and sponsor this festival along with North Dakota Council on the Arts.
Well, let's get a sample of what people are going to hear at the upcoming 29th annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival at Cross Ranch State Park outside of Washburn. Again, it's Friday and Saturday, June 14th and 15th. And here's a sample of the Clay Hess Band from Ohio. Well, Jill, that was up-tempo.
Yeah, it's something, I'll tell you. It's just hard to believe they're going to be here next weekend all the way from Ohio.
Well, for our listeners, and remind me, what are the essential elements of bluegrass music?
You know, the bluegrass music is all acoustic instruments, and most of the time we all play into a microphone, so obviously it amplifies and you can hear it. There's a lot of gospel in bluegrass music. There's a lot of harmony. I think we're kind of known for that in the bluegrass world. Everyone sings and everyone can pick. And I think that's what I love mostly about the music is not only are they standing up on stage singing, they're singing harmony, they're playing their instrument, and they take a break or a lead, if you will. And it just is so inspiring to see these musicians, how well they are.
Well, when you got a few hundred people out there listening to something mm-hmm. like that, are they raising dust? Are they stomping and clogging and carrying on?
You know, it's kind of a conservative crowd up there.
So it's like a concert?
Well, yes, and it is. And we do have a few young folks, and they are welcome to dance. And you know, they'll kind of hover in the back. A lot of kids like to dance. And a lot of little kids, like I'm talking age 2 to 5. And they'll find their way up to the stage right in front there, and they'll dance around, their diaper hanging off, whatever. And I mean, it's, you know, we don't allow alcohol in the concert setting, if you will. Somebody might sneak something in their Yeti or something, but we want to keep it family friendly where you are there in your lawn chair and your toddler is laying next to you taking a nap. I mean, it's different than from a big outside country festival, if you will. It's very pretty tame, but very exciting nonetheless. And you know, there might, you know, people head back to their campsites and jam, and that's where there might be something going on, and maybe even a little moonshine. I don't know what these guys are bringing us, but truth be told, it's just a family-friendly, safe, laid-back environment. You know, the big cottonwood trees, a lot of people will bring a hammock and just tie it up and lay there and listen to the music and hang out. There's a few folks who will bring a little picnic, like a card table, and set up, and they'll be in the way back just playing cards.
Well, I don't
just hanging
know.
Out, yeah.
I don't know how you can listen to music like that without tapping your toes.
No, I am in the front row. I am always in the front row, and I just can't be anywhere else. When I do get to sit down, it's the front row. Yeah.
Now, this is sponsored by the Society for the Preservation of Bluegrass Music of America. Give us a description of that organization.
Well, actually, this is sponsored by the Bluegrass Association of North Dakota, the Band Association, and the North Dakota Council on the Arts is we write a grant for that because the Bluegrass Association is a nonprofit. So we qualify through there to write a grant. And of course, the Washburn and Center businesses, both communities are very, very helpful. Our Washburn American Legion and some of the banks and everyone is on board to help keep this going, you know, to help the state, because actually the North Dakota State Parks is who sponsors it. You know, they have to pay the bill at the end of the weekend.
So is there food on site or people bring that in?
You know, there is. We have Kyle's Catering from Garrison, and he's down there all weekend starting late Friday afternoon. And so, yeah, you don't even have to bring any food, really. I mean, it's pretty. We have 4 families that feed the headline bands Friday night, Saturday breakfast, and then Saturday night there's a potluck for all the musicians. So it's very community-oriented in the visitor center for the performers to all hang around.
Well, Jill Weiss, you've been with the Cottonwood Band how long?
You know, it's 18 years. So, I mean, we're the traditional 4. We have our son-in-law, Reed Buckley, on the fiddle now, and he's just brought pure joy to the band, and he's 30 years old and came from a family band in Roundup, Montana, so we're so grateful to have him on board. And same group of guys, Dan Foster and Keith Cook and Lee Benjamin and I, and we're very grateful that we're able to play together this long.
And you have a new CD?
We do. It came out about a year ago, and it's called County Road 18. And we live on the gravel road, County Road 18, and it's a song we wrote about our daughter Ashley moving away when she graduated from high school. It's a very fun song.
So when you put together a CD, is it all original stuff or is it a mix?
You know, it's a mix. We do a lot of traditional. We do songs. On this CD, we reached out to Jimmy Fortune, who used to sing with the Statler Brothers.
Wow.
And he's out on his own now, and he wrote a song about his mom, and it's called I Believe. And I changed the words and altered them a little bit about my sister Barb, who died of breast cancer. And so I reached out to Jimmy and asked if I could record the song, and he's absolutely. And I told him how I changed the words a little bit, not a problem. And, you know, the only thing is I have to send him a CD. They always want to hear how we did it.
Well, we should mention that you also work at the Bismarck Cancer Center and that you have this annual fundraising event, right?
We do. Bluegrass Goes Pink is our 8th annual this year at the Cross Ranch State Park, and it's July 27th. Phenomenal event. All the nurses and friends at the Bismarck Cancer Center come up to help. It's just really become something. All the Washburn churches make all the food for the evening meal at 5, and we added a 5 and a 10K walk run in the morning, and that gets another group of people out, you know, to enjoy the morning and run and walk. well, on the trails.
Coming up, though, is the 29th Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival. It's June 14th and 15th, Friday and Saturday at Cross Ranch State Park outside of Washburn. Jill, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And we'll leave our listeners with a cut from your old Sanger Hall CD. This is Save Your Goodbye.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This June, you can get involved, have fun, and learn new skills at the Sleepy Hollow Summer Arts Camp in Bismarck. Be a part of the cast of Madagascar, Newsies, or Mamma Mia. Or you can check out programs like Rising Stars, chess, painting, comic books, taekwondo, beginning improvisation, Harry Potter, and more. It's all at Sleepy Hollow Summer Camps, with professional instructors for 3 separate weeks beginning June 3rd. More information online at shtap.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. June is Pride Month, with Capital Pride events coming up this weekend in Bismarck. To acknowledge the occasion, we have another episode of the Breaking Barriers podcast. The podcast is an outgrowth of the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project called Breaking Barriers, harvesting LGBTQ stories from the Northern Plains. Many of the participants in that project grew up when being out was not a practical option. 50 years ago, in 1969, discrimination and police crackdowns against gays and lesbians led to the violent Stonewall riots in New York. Lynn Runk was 27 years old at the time. A short time later, in 1972, he saw a need to help gays who were struggling in that difficult social environment. He visits with interviewer Jan Titus in this excerpt from his oral history.
I met a couple of nice guys and became good friends. And one was a hotel manager, and he committed suicide. And he committed suicide because I don't think he could handle his gay life. Mm-hmm. And I felt really bad that there are men out there that were, this was happening to maybe, and I didn't know about it. And I knew a lady that worked for the Fargo Mental Health Association. And we talked about it, and she got in hold of the North Dakota Mental Health lady from Bismarck. And we got together for a noon luncheon, which lasted a couple hours. And she felt there should be something done, and I did too. And we thought that we should do something, a program of some sort. And this is where the AWARE program started.
Okay.
And we needed money to do this. So she knew a person, the lady from Fargo, knew a person that knew how to write grants. And we got in contact with him, and he says, I'll write the grant for you, but I don't know if you will get this grant. He wrote the grant, and a month or so later, he came back and says, you received a grant for $10,000. He says, you can put on your program. And we called it Homosexuality in Our Society. Mm. It was held at a local hotel, a room capacity probably maybe 150 people. We put it together. We did advertising on Prairie Public Television, which was a good place, and another television station. We got over 300 people in there. People were standing in the hallways. And it was, a lot of them were parents, a lot of them were young college kids. We brought in 4 speakers, and that's the money we used to bring these speakers on.
Okay.
Then we just felt that this started to open the eyes to the people here in the state of North Dakota. So gradually people started coming out and starting to come public with their sexuality. Some still stayed in the closet, which was too bad. And we did have some, we've lost some people. And some were good friends and some were acquaintances.
Yeah.
And we've had some tragedy here too, with some guys getting murdered. So, and that's too bad.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I'm just so happy to hear about this senior, gay senior. That just, I went to a function the last night, and it's getting bigger and better, and I've met a lot of the old faces, which is fun. Yeah.
You know, over the years, how have you noticed that in terms of how people treat you, how you see yourself, how you interact with others, how has that changed over your lifetime?
I'm more open today. And I think that has to do, to me, it has to do with my age, because I don't give a damn at 76 right now. And what are they going to do to you, you know? And it's so much more open today. I mean, you got television, you had Will and Grace, which was the icebreaker, and then people around here all thought that just happened out on the West Coast. No, it's right here. But I'm open with myself and a lot of people I meet. And when your two guys are together, you know, people ask us, well, how long have you guys been together? You know, 20 years, okay. And then the people say, well, I have a niece or I have a nephew, which they would never say that 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But but I really see this in Palm Springs, in the Catholic Church. I see a lot of couples in church, and I start to see them here, too. And one thing that Craig and I have started to do, instead of shaking each other's hand for peace, we've given each other a big hug now.
Mm-hmm.
And in Palm Springs, I see that in the Catholic Church out there. And I've even seen guys kiss one another. I mean, older guys. So, and I think that it's just so, so great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sign of peace.
The Breaking Barriers podcast is edited by Prairie Public and can be found on the Prairie Public podcast page. The full-length oral histories will eventually be available as part of North Dakota State University's archives. It's an ongoing project, and if you wish to get involved, you can email redriverrainboworalhistory@gmail.com. Meanwhile, Capital Pride kicks off this Friday night in Bismarck with a party and a riverboat cruise. It continues a Saturday with Pride on the Capitol lawn, and then in the evening, the Dakota Divas perform at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium. On Sunday, a multi-faith service will be held at Sertoma Park, with a potluck to follow. Dakota Datebook is next.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about, well, President Jefferson dressing down.
Jefferson was a master of what is known as political theater. He walked to his inauguration. He sent up his State of the Union message by courier. He wore house slippers when he greeted foreign dignitaries.
And he offended some of those foreign dignitaries greatly.
He wanted to show the world, and particularly the British, that we were a republic, not a monarchy, that we were the new world, not the old, and that he, as president, was really the first citizen, not in any way the great potentate or master of American life.
We talk about how these were premeditated actions and what that tells us about Jefferson's character.
But I also believe that Jefferson was just an eccentric, and some of this was inevitable, even if he wasn't showing a Republican pose to his detractors.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for June 12th.
On this date in 1919, the Weekly Times Record of Valley City noted that coming home wasn't always easy for returning veterans. Newsreels showed joyous films of ships being greeted by cheering crowds. Newspapers ran front-page pictures of celebrity parades. Towns across the country welcomed their veterans with concerts, parades, and picnics. But the newspaper noted that homecoming was not so glorious for every veteran. Some didn't have a home to go to. Others didn't know if they had a home or not. Some had not received a letter from home in months. Some hadn't received a letter the entire time they were gone. For these veterans, coming home was not the grand and glorious event portrayed in the movies, newspapers, and magazines. Almost unknown in World War I history is the Hall of States. It was established to ease the homecoming for veterans facing an uncertain future. Located in Washington, it was designed to be warm and welcoming. States sent representatives to help returning veterans. The state flag and the name of the state were prominently displayed at the desk representing each state. The Hall of States was furnished with comfortable armchairs where veterans could smoke and relax. It was easy for them to find the desk for the appropriate state and talk to someone who was there to help. Representatives could look through records and send telegrams and make telephone calls. They did whatever they could to find any information the veteran needed. It was not unusual for unexpected reunions to take place. Veterans would brighten when they saw a familiar face from their home state. On one occasion, three brothers met for the first time since the war started. Mrs. Frank White represented North Dakota. Her husband was a colonel, still stationed in France. Her son was in the Navy and hadn't come home yet, but she was determined to help North Dakota veterans ease their concerns and have a good homecoming. She also went to the hospital to meet with North Dakota veterans who couldn't come to the Hall of States in person. Mrs. White claimed that the North Dakota boys, being from a dry state, were glad to get home because in France, the liquor ran freely. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You know, your first impression of Sidney Rittenberg is his charm.
A young American soldier was deployed to China during World War II. He stayed for 35 years. How he became a Chinese revolutionary and Chairman Mao's greatest backer.
I was part of something that was moving forward and that would win. So I never thought of giving up.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, there are so many talented musicians in this region that we like to celebrate them from time to time with the Prairie Musicians television show airing right here on Prairie Public. We visit with our own Barb Gravel. She is the television department's production manager and the lead producer of Prairie Musicians, and she previews the upcoming season. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.